companions. We help you discover your many layers. You peel, you cry, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
This episode took courage to produce. It's a hush-hush topic in Singapore. People don't like to talk about it. And it's often seen as controversial. But this was something we felt we had to talk about to open up this conversation. So, let's talk about race.
Hi, my name is Adib Faza, and I'm the artistic director of a Singapore-based theatre company called The Second Breakfast Company, and this was established in 2016. I'm also a drama educator. I teach across different levels, mostly secondary, as well as polytechnic educating using drama. That's basically what I do.
So, yeah. A bit of context into how we got to this episode. So this episode is about race in Singapore, which is a huge topic, very rarely discussed. So there, a bit of context. So it was the Raisa Kahan sort of incident during the 2020 election campaign in Singapore that kind of started this conversation that we're having now with each other. And so someone lodged a police report against the opposition Workers' Party candidate Raisa Kahan concerning intemperate remarks she had made in the past about the system being rigged against minorities with reference to the City Harvest Church scandal, in which they misappropriated $24 million in City Harvest Church's building funds through sham bonds investments and then misused a further $26 million to cover up the initial crime. And in February 2018, Raisa Kahan's Facebook post wrote, "Singapore jails minorities mercilessly, harasses mosque leaders, but lets corrupt church leaders who stole SGD 50 million walk free. Who did they pay?" And she immediately apologized, but the main political party, the PAP, issued a party statement that inaccurately claimed that she had, by her own admission, made anti-Chinese and anti-Christian comments. And then the Second Breakfast Company released a company statement on Raisa Kahan. Do you want to talk about it?
We did. I think we felt the need to make public our stance on the whole situation, and I think it was about also giving the assurance to people of the minority that we're not here for it. We're not here for the injustice. And I think putting out the statement was also our way of saying, you know what, we disagree. We disagree on the stance out there that is basically not listening to her. And for us, it's about saying that, okay, we hear where she's coming from. We hear that, you know, we acknowledge that injustices exist, such as the ones that she's pointed out, and we are putting our foot down to say that we, you know, we agree with her and not whatever else that's attacking her. Yeah.
So a little bit more context, right? Section 298A of the Penal Code in Singapore states that whoever, by words or either spoken or written, or by signs or by visible representations or otherwise, knowingly promotes or attempts to promote on grounds of religion or race, disharmony or feelings of enmity, hatred or ill will between different religious or racial groups, or B, commits any act which he knows is prejudicial to the maintenance of harmony between different religious or racial groups and which disturbs or is likely to disturb the public tranquility, shall be punished with imprisonment for a term which may extend to 3 years or with fine or with both. So this is actually really problematic because this means that you can't talk about anything that is racist, especially on media in public. And it becomes a situation of minorities who have suffered from certain acts of racism or discrimination can't feel safe enough to actually be able to voice it out because you have the majority who would perhaps always deny those experiences or or indicate that this is like, you know, oversensitivity, and you know, you are just trying to disturb the still of the water when nothing is going on.
Yeah, I like the analogy of disturbing the still of the water, because then what water are we in that that's making you comfortable, that making other people uncomfortable, that there's this imbalance, right, in this water. So what is this water that we're in that you're saying that, you know, we're trying to stir?
And then also taken from the site Air Conditioned Nation, actually this is a law with roots in British colonial times, devised by rulers more concerned about taming native subjects than building a multicultural nation. And a little bit more context, I quote from the book Singapore State and Society. The operationalization of racial ideology had its roots from British colonization of the region in the 1800s, where differences between the races were emphasized and inequality among the migrant population was explained using notions of inherent racial categories, which is the social formula called the CMIO model, Singapore, Chinese, Malay, Indian, and other. So can we or can we not talk about race? Should we or should we not talk about race?
it's an age-old question, isn't it? Like, do we have the space? Do we have the time? But on the other hand, do we want the space and do we want the time to entertain questions about race? To entertain conversations about race? Are we, you know, by shutting down someone who's speaking up, such as Raiza Khan in her Twitter post, by shutting that conversation down, I think that's a big signal for everybody that there is a very low tolerance. And perhaps because of that, we should be talking more about race. We should be, you know, creating the space for ourselves. We should be asking for space to be created, to have those conversations, to have those exchanges, so that we can all be learning.
Isn't this like a chicken and egg question as well? Because for us to be willing or able to create that space to have these conversations, we need a larger sense of awareness or consciousness of this issue. And fundamentally, we as active citizens need to care for other members in society. And like, really, let's just talk a little bit about, so the Black Lives Matter movement that happened, sort of started in the US and then it went on kind of viral globally. What was the sort of response in Singapore at that time?
Oh, I think it was quite interesting to see the response. So for one, I think there was a lot of talk about the specific context of the US and what people in the US are going through. There was a lot of discussion, I think, especially, you know, when you look at social media, for example, people were posting up the black squares, and talking about, you know, injustices in society. And so I would say the response was that there were a lot of people who were, I mean, to say this quite respectfully, who were, I think, on the surface, you know, hoping to show their support and hoping to demonstrate their support for the Black Lives Matter movement from wherever they are. So I think the response was actually quite interesting in that it was a lot more than I personally expected, and there was a lot of support for it here in Singapore.
Did it translate into Singapore specific conversations?
I don't think so. And I think there was quite a distinction, I think, when we talk about using, you know, conversations, using explorations, academic material about Black Lives Matter, for example, or in general, any overseas ideologies. It's very, I think people are quite cautious about recontextualizing it into a Singapore context. And I think that can be said about this idea of Chinese privilege, which has been, you know, attacked as something that is a foreign import, and we don't like, you know, we don't like this idea of just transposing, you know, ideologies from somewhere else onto a Singapore context, because Singapore is a very unique place with our own unique set of whatever issues and unique contextual background. So I think, you know, to answer your question, I don't think there was a lot of that. I think people are very cautious about doing so.
But you know what was really interesting for me? I was in Canada when Black Lives Matter happened, and there were all these resources. I mean, obviously they were not books that were written and published during the Black Lives Matter movement. They were published years ago, and it just, because of this movement, you know, these books resurfaced and people were really actively reading about it and educating themselves. And I sensed that sort of like awareness and willingness and desire to engage in, you know, learning more, educating themselves in terms of the Western context. And it was so nice for me to see that, also because like books and language, it gives us the vocabulary and the terms to put into words, put into a form the experiences that someone goes through, and to explain it in a way where more people can try and understand. Because this issue of race, it's something that's actually very difficult to talk about and very difficult to explain, even if you are the one experiencing it. Like how... there is so much of making sense to do when you first experience it, and then trying to talk about it. But if you're not talking about it with the right people who understand, the very first responses you will get is probably people invalidating your experiences, saying that you are too sensitive. And, yeah. And then it's like an entire journey of actually understanding yourself, your context in that society, understanding your experiences, internalizing all of that, and have the confidence to say that, no, this is what it is. Like this, these are my feelings, these are my experiences. And to have the right words for it, that's like another journey altogether. And there's this thing that I want to share by Robin DiAngelo. So she wrote a book called White Fragility. And I quote, "If, however, I understand racism as a system into which I was socialized, I can receive feedback on my problematic racial patterns as a helpful way to support my learning and growth." And then she goes on to sort of like define and categorize racism, discrimination, and what they all mean, which I think is really important. So bear with me, I'm going to go through it. So racism, to understand racism, we need to first distinguish it from mere prejudice and discrimination. Prejudice is prejudgment about another person based on the social groups to which that person belongs. Prejudice consists of thoughts and feelings, including stereotypes, attitudes, and generalizations that are based on little or no experience, and then are projected onto everyone from that group. Our prejudices tend to be shared because we swim in the same cultural water and absorb the same messages. All humans have prejudice. We cannot avoid it. If I'm aware that a social group exists, I will have gained information about that group from the society around me. This information helps me make sense of the group from my cultural framework. Discrimination is action based on prejudice. These actions include ignoring, exclusion, threats, ridicule, slander, and violence. For example, if hatred is the emotion we feel because of our prejudice, extreme acts of discrimination such as violence may follow. But if what we feel is more subtle, such as mild discomfort, the discrimination is likely to also be subtle, even hard to detect. Many of us can acknowledge that we do feel some unease around certain groups of people, if only a heightened sense of self-consciousness. But this feeling doesn't come naturally. Our unease comes from living separate from a group of people while simultaneously absorbing incomplete or erroneous information about them. When the prejudice causes me to act differently, I am less relaxed around you, or I avoid interacting with you, I am now discriminating. Prejudice always manifests itself in action because the way I see the world drives my actions in the world. Everyone has prejudice and everyone discriminates. So like, I thought this was like really poignant because it's saying that it's not your fault. This is the way that the system is. This is the way that society views certain things. And these prejudices and discriminations, it's unhealthy, but it's not to point fingers at anyone, but rather that accepting that this is a part of being integrated into society, that is what you take on. But then knowing that, understanding that, identifying the issues within it, and then it's our responsibility to work towards unpacking that and tackling it so that we can unpack all of these different prejudices, discrimination, and work towards a more inclusive society.
Yeah, no, I think it's when you can acknowledge that there is that subtle difference, that nobody's, you know, pointing fingers, nobody's saying, oh, you are a horrible person because you just did something that was racist or whatever. I think that comes also from this system, you know, that's been created to quell conversations around racism, so that there's this idea, right, that if someone is a racist, or if someone is even close to, you know, being called a racist, that person is morally a bad person. And because of that, I think there is a high kind of defense wall that people are building when even, you know, being confronted with like the most remote kind of calling out, you know, of that person's act that could be considered racist. Yeah.
There was like this incident. I forgot if it was recently. So MediaCorp actor and DJ Dennis Chu dressed and acted as multiple characters of different races in Singapore, such as a Malay woman in a headscarf and an Indian man with darkened skin, a Chinese woman in a pink jacket, and a Chinese man with a moustache in the advertisement. And then Singaporean playwright Alfian Saad commented that the act reduces an entire race to physical features that are supposed to be reproducible through makeup, while at the same time ridiculing those features. And when you get a Chinese person to do racial drag, you're effectively saying that being Chinese in Singapore is the standard and all other races are deviations from the standard. In one of the photos, Dennis Chu tries to play an Indian man called Muthusami. His skin is darkened, he wears an oily looking wig with curls, he has narrow eyes, so he widens them, and the effect is that he looks deranged. He elaborated, adding that there is nothing innocent about attempting to portray an Indian man in such a manner. What were your thoughts on this incident?
I think my thoughts really came, really became clearer to me when I saw the amount of backlash. backlash, not so much against the act, you know, on the part of Dennis Chu, but backlash against the people who were criticizing what was being done by Dennis Chu and whoever, MediaCorp. I think that was really the alarm bells for me, more so than the actual act. So what was going on was the backlash against Dennis Chu was that he was performing brownface, which is like a sparse equivalent of this idea of blackface, and then the retaliation against that criticism was, you know, in all shapes and sizes. People were saying things like brownface doesn't exist, brownface isn't disrespectful, how is it disrespectful, he's just putting on a costume and makeup. Isn't that just part of his job? So going further and back to our point earlier about, you know, adapting academic work and ideologies, there were people going on about how brown face is just something that was made up to cause division and tension between people of different ethnic groups in Singapore by simply copying, you know, the conversations that were being held overseas. And please stop importing, you know, these ideas that are not relevant to us. So So yeah, I think I was more appalled at that backlash, just because we were on the cusp of having you know a great conversation, a great learning point as a society, and by having this whole notion of you know brown face, it was maybe not. Maybe not an existing idea, maybe not a well-known idea, but it was something that I think it could have started a decent kind of dialogue about how the different races are being portrayed in the media and how we represent ourselves as a society, you know, in the media. And I feel that on the one hand, you know, the media does try, the Singapore media does try. You kind of see this, for example, in the tiny little ways that people do casting. For example, POSB, it's like this bank in Singapore. They currently have this ongoing campaign about their everyday card, which is like a very standard kind of product, but the face on the front of it is a lady of South Asian descent, and she is a couple with this other man who is not. So that's interesting. You also have Channel 5 dramas that are quite like long running. Point of Entry, for example, had like the brainiac character of this team of, you know, highly trained, I don't even know, police investigators. But the person who was acting as like the genius on the team was this woman of Malay descent. And you know, that for me is very, it's very interesting, it's very progressive. And on the other hand, you have the bad track record from from the likes of Channel 8, who, you know, doing darkened skin using face makeup and paint or whatever. It's not their first time. That's not the first time someone has done something like that in recent history. You know, just a couple of years before, there was a TV show in which an actor by the name of Shane Pao came on to the camera in black paint on his face, and he was supposed to be like this I think African character. And then there was, they even went further to do this thing where they were like, oh, I don't know if I'm African or Indian. and it's quite appalling that went all the way to national television. Yeah, where, you know, at so many points, you know, there was someone looking at the thing, looking at the script, looking at the costume makeup choices, looking at the direction, the editing, cinematography, the I don't know. So many places they could have stopped that from going out, but they did. But yeah, so then could we have that quite timely, I suppose, conversation about representation, about how we see and how we represent ourselves in our own media as a society. So I feel that opportunity was quickly lost. Mm. You know, in the sea of this retaliation against that kind of criticism. Because then the question was about, no, you shouldn't even be talking about this. You shouldn't be upset. You shouldn't be, you know, and that was a lost opportunity. And then it further propagates this environment where people of minority couldn't feel like they were being heard, couldn't feel like they could talk, couldn't feel like their feelings were valid. So that episode, you know, in Singapore's history ended, and we kept moving on with the rest of the show as if nothing happened, but with even more, you know, fear, I think, of speaking up and of letting our feelings be known to a larger you know, group of people.
Mm.
Yeah.
Also to note is that Channel 8 is one of the two main channels, Chinese-speaking channels. So what would likely happen is that because they are mostly Chinese productions, it will most likely be ethnically Chinese Singaporeans will be in the production crew all the way to the point in which it's screened on TV. This kind of goes back to the previous point on the penal code that we have in Singapore. So what is acceptable and what isn't, right?
Yeah.
And also, like, let's talk about your experiences making theater in Singapore, because, you know, arts have the opportunity to actually open up such conversations in a way that connects stories and connects humans through empathy and understanding. But how is this really possible in Singapore with with the way that it is with National Arts Council? What are your experiences?
It can be quite complex, I think, just because of the way, you know, the arts ecosystem has been shaped. And it also comes down to the economy. It's a very small economy. There's very little money. And so the competition for it is very high. It's very stiff. And because of that, a lot of people's projects, so let's say in the theater industry, a lot of the shows, you know, that go up really depend on government funding from bodies such as the Tote Board Arts Fund, as well as the National Arts Council. So they have this thing that's always ongoing called the presentation grant, where if you're typically speaking, if you're putting up a show, you would apply for the presentation grant and they would award you with a small grant. And, you know, as much as the Arts Council tries to be fair and accountable, a lot of the questions that I have about the way it works is to do with, gatekeeping and gatekeeping in a way that because they are a government body, they feel that they have some kind of obligation to uphold quote unquote, you know, largely accepted values and not condone anything that sort of falls outside of that purview. I think just going back to the way the economy works, if I'm going to do a show that will discuss issues of race, it might involve, for example, a character being racist to another character. It might involve that. And if it does, then, you know, I'm going to leave it in there. There's a talking point, there's a learning point, whatever. So I might do this show and I would probably apply for a grant under the National Arts Council presentation grant. But, you know, I think the way that the rules have been laid out also allows for a lot of speculation, a lot of gray area, a lot of just guessing whether this is going to be okay or not.
Hold on to your point. I'm going to just read out like what is written on their like application page. Okay. So while we consider diversity of expression and are open to balanced dialogue in the arts, as a government body disbursing public funds in line with government policies, CDC will not consider proposals which advocate or lobby for lifestyles seen as objectionable by the general public, denigrate or debase a person, group or class of individuals on the basis of race or religion, or serve to create conflict or misunderstanding in our multicultural and multireligious society, and undermine the authority or legitimacy of the government and public institutions, or threaten the nation's security or stability. It's very grey.
Right, it doesn't it just feel like, okay, there are many words, but there's also still so much to unpack. And if there's no space to do that, if there's no conversation, how do we do that? It's just there's a lot of smoke that we have to, you know, navigate, that we have to skillfully navigate. So, yeah, I mean, there was a piece of work that I was going to do earlier this year that was exploring, for example, the policy change, the overnight policy change about the ruling of the use of PMDs, personal mobility devices, in Singapore, both on the roads as well as on pavements. And we pitched this project to the National Arts Council for this thing that they've opened up this year in response to COVID-19 called the Digital Presentation Grant. And this grant will give you some money to present a work digitally in whatever format. So we were just going to do something that we thought was interesting, was also urgent to talk about, because the whole issue has many layers to it. There's a lot of discussion in that issue about the social economics of the people involved, the policy and how that came to be. So for context, sometime in 2019, in November, there was an overnight ruling saying we are now completely banning the use of personal mobility devices on the roads as well as on the pavements. And this affected a bulk of food delivery riders from companies such as GrabFood, FoodPanda, Deliveroo, Honestbee, and so on, because they might have had already invested in their equipment and suddenly they couldn't use it. And because it was an overnight situation, they get the news right on a certain day, and then the next day they couldn't go to work. They couldn't go to work because they had to make separate arrangements first before resuming their business. So that affected the livelihood of so many people, and was the ban in the first place the best way forward? Was the ban calculated with these people in mind so that they would be least affected, especially when we're talking about their their livelihoods? And so we put in this application and we got rejected. And I think that's one of the ways that that we face censorship. I can see where they're coming from with regards to accountability, but as an arts council, is that something that you need to that you're obliged to upkeep? What is the arts that you are nurturing, right? If you are going to pick and choose the kinds of stories being told, the kind of questions being raised in the arts that you support, that you back financially. So we got rejected on the basis of stiff competition, and which is very typical, nothing new. But the twist in this story is they ended up extending the deadline for the digital presentation grant in order to encourage more submissions. So for me, is it really a question of stiff competition for the funding? It's hard for me to believe. So the suspicion is that there is a kind of avoidance to open up and allow and support these kind of artworks that want to question, status quo, that want to have these deeper conversations. And I think one of the reasons they couldn't support the work also was that this was going to touch on policymaking. And, going back to the blurb about not making the government look like, undermining the authority and whatever. So I think that's just one example, but I would also argue that the issue of that overnight ban affected one group more than another. I wouldn't go so far as to say it affected one race or ethnic group, but I think it's about the socioeconomic demographics of Singapore society, and one group was definitely affected more than the other. If we don't have that conversation, we aren't acknowledging, you know, a minority group's plight, a minority group's life, and their experience of being suppressed or attacked in whatever way, and you know, having their livelihoods taken away just like that from under the rug. And then if you have, you know, works that you want to do that talk about race or religion, it's also going to be a tricky kind of situation. I did have another grant application years ago that was rejected. And, you know, again, it's just a suspicion, because they don't tell you outright. But the suspicion for me was that because the characters in the play do discuss ideas of religion, do discuss, you know, life, the interactions, it portrays interactions between people of very different religious views. And for me, that was a very interesting conversation to be had about, you know, the modern world, the modern life in Singapore, where you just meet all kinds of people and you end up living with all kinds of people or you know, in close contact with. So that was a project that, interestingly, we didn't get funding, but we went ahead and did it anyway. And we raised funds, you know, crowdfunding and all that, in other ways, and we made it work for ourselves just because we thought it was important to go ahead with the project, not to be deterred, you know, just because the signal is that this conversation should never be held. It's a tricky situation or whatever. So I think funding is one way that you know, that one way that I would say is quite a contentious means of controlling the national conversations. Another way, you know, that these stories are being controlled and curated is obviously licensing. And licensing comes from this body now called the IMDA. And the IMDA issues licenses and ratings for movies, for whatever things that are being broadcast, as well as for live performances. So you have to apply for a license from the IMDA in order to put on a live show. And the rating that we received, for example, for that project that we went ahead with a couple of years back, was an advisory 16, if I'm not wrong. And wow. Yeah. And for live performance, the highest rating you can get is R18. So we just fell short of that, you know, conversation. And because of that advisory 16, technically you can have people under 16 or people 16 years old come and see the show, but because the advisory is there and it's made by the IMDA, a government, you know, body, parents tend to be more cautious, teachers tend to be more cautious, educators will probably not take the risk to send their students to something which has an advisory.
This is a huge hit, isn't it? Because we don't have any theater goers to begin with in Singapore. And then you cut off the education section, that's not much left.
Right, exactly. And you know, we are a young people facing kind of company where a lot of our audiences are either students or young adults, a lot of the people that we face. So for us to not be able to sell tickets, for example, to students, to school audiences, was a huge blow. You know, it wasn't as though we knew from the start that we were going to get an advisory 16, because we thought, to us, this was a balanced kind of exploration of the topic of religion. And so, you know, going in, we didn't expect anything until, you know, we were like a month in before the show opened, where we were wondering when we would get our rating and our license. And it was only the week before that we actually got our rating. Wow. So And that's the thing, right? You can't sell tickets to schools without a license, without a rating, because they would ask for it. You can't apply for the arts education program that gives discounts to students at school bookings without a rating. So, you know, that was not a pleasant experience for us dealing with the different government bodies who just felt like they weren't supportive of the arts that ask difficult questions.
Is there even any part in Singapore that promotes this asking of difficult questions?
Hey everyone, this episode's a little long, so I've split it into two parts. Coming up in part two are more tips on addressing racism from a position of privilege, but also for people at the receiving end of it. Do stay tuned and subscribe to Onions Talk to get updates on new episodes.